The Guardian.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, and 24/7 support. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer code Guardian to get 10% off.
Hello and welcome back to Tech Weekly with me, Alex Kratofsky, on the show this week.
Because it seemed like a lot of what we were getting as ebooks were sort of just pale gray imitations of print books. If we were going to lose all the nice things about a print book, we should be getting something good in return. And so this was our attempt to start exploring that.
I meet author Eli Horowitz to discuss his digital reinvention of the novel in The Silent History and why the novel's structure is currently ripe for innovation. Also this week, U.S. police pay out their first Bitcoin ransom. The Oracle that is Sir Tim Berners-Lee speaks out against surveillance technologies and how they're undermining public confidence in the web. And the 8-year battle between Google and the Authors Guild is finally over. Stay tuned to find out what happened to Tech Weekly from The Guardian. It's been a big week for Bitcoin, the digital currency that some are saying is the future of exchange. Optimism or pessimism aside, there are two more reasons this week why we're having a closer look at this modern economic miracle. One, you can pay ransom to the authorities in Bitcoin. And two, you can go to space with them. Alex Hearn is The Guardian's resident Bitcoin expert. Alex, what's going on?
Bitcoin has just entered the zeitgeist, basically. As far as I can tell, all of these separate stories are unrelated on a larger level. These are just a bunch of different groups, different people who've each decided that now is the time to use or to take a closer look at Bitcoin. On the one hand, there's some criminals who've decided that it's a fairly easy way of collecting large amounts of ransom money when they're holding your data captive. And on the other hand, there's Richard Branson, who really just quite liked the PR opportunity of taking a payment in a new currency.
Never. Not Richard Branson looking for a PR opportunity.
He's so shy and retiring.
He's extraordinary, isn't he? I mean, it's so actually, does Virgin Galactic's use of Bitcoin, pay your down payment in Bitcoin here, is that actually a thing? I mean, should we be getting excited about this? Or should we be more interested in the fact that Bitcoin is being used for ransom?
I think Virgin Galactic's stunt is that what they're offering to do is the opportunity to take your Bitcoin and convert it into US dollars and pay the bill in US dollars. It's not really much more than that. The ransom thing is more interesting in what it says about Bitcoin, that it is what it set out to be. It's a new cash, just as you used to ask for $1 million in unmarked, unsequential bills to be delivered outside the post office at 11:30 a.m., come alone. You now ask for 2 bitcoins to be sent to an unmarked wallet address on the network, and they'll send you the keys to the data that they encrypted on your hard drive.
So my question here is, because all bitcoins have to be validated by the network, in effect, every bitcoin has a sort of serial number. So when this happens, when someone, we see reports all the time of hackers steal $1 million in bitcoins, and it might be sort of 7 bitcoins or something, depending on the price at the time. But why is it that those bitcoin movements can't be tracked on the network, and then people say, well, look, they're sitting over there, and we just won't deal with that wallet over there, and particularly we won't allow these bitcoins, because we know the numbers, because they have to be validated against the network, we won't allow these to come onto the network?
The basic reason is just that, you're herding cats. This is the whole point of Bitcoin, is that it's a decentralized currency. There is no single authority that can make this sort of decree. Actually, if you could get together 51% of the miners, the people processing the transaction on the Bitcoin network, if you could get together more than half of them, you could do more than just blacklist these coins. You could roll back the transactions. This is the way Bitcoin works. All of these miners are acting together, pursuing their own enlightened self-interest in a wonderful sort of anarcho-capitalist way, and out of it comes this vague order. The problem is that trying to convince 51% of a massive decentralized network that is mostly people just processing transactions without question, purely to get the reward at the end of it, trying to convince them to do something based on any other reason is borderline impossible.
So it'd be sort of like posting the serial numbers of a whole lot of bills that have been stolen and left outside the bank in your wonderful ransom scenario, sort of posting those all over the town and saying, don't take these bills.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, if you post sequential bills, if someone pays a ransom in sequential bills, the government can tell banks, yo, if you get these numbers, don't take them, return them to us, these are stolen money, these are forged, whatever. Yeah.
But with cash, it doesn't necessarily go through banks, does it?
And if you had no government and no banks, then it comes down to just trying to tell every individual person to check the serial number of every banknote they take. It rapidly becomes very difficult. And with Bitcoin, although you can follow the transaction, you have no way of linking the transaction, or it's very difficult to link the transactions to people. So you can see that a random alphanumeric address has taken hold of these stolen bitcoins, but you can't communicate with the owner of that address and go, hey, you've got some stolen bitcoins, you might want to return them.
So up until this point, Alex, it really has been, you know, it's been a small number, a very intimate community, as it were, of, you know, quite a distributed network of people who have been mining or have been using bitcoins. But why, over the last couple of weeks, as you wrote in your article this week on TheGuardian.com, why have, and I'm going to quote here, the chairman of the U.S. Federal Reserve, the Bank of England, the Olympic rowing and Zuckerberg bothering Winklevoss twins, and the U.S. Department of Homeland Security all suddenly become interested in Bitcoin over the last couple of weeks?
Well, the Winklevi.
Is that their official title?
I'm not sure it's theirs, but it's certainly the recognized plural. The Winklevi are slightly the odd one out of that, because firstly, they became interested a bit earlier. They bought, it was something like 5% of all known bitcoins a few months ago. And also because they're interested in it purely as a money-making opportunity. They think they can get very, very rich off the back of it. The other three are more interesting. There seems to be a growing realization that Bitcoin may be more than just an exciting speculative bubble, that there may be something about the technology that underpins it and its position in the world we're in today that warrants a closer look. I mean, a speculative bubble doesn't hurt. If it doubles in value, anything that doubles in value overnight, people are going to look closely at.
Well, it certainly has been extraordinary. I've been watching Bitcoin. I have a little printer in my house, and one of the services that the little printer prints out every day is the Bitcoin exchange rate. And about a month ago, I recall that it was at 74 Bitcoins to the US dollar. And this morning, today, it was 550 Bitcoins. That's within a month.
By the way, around, I think, $550 per Bitcoin.
Excuse me. Yes, of course. Yeah. That's a pretty extraordinary leap. How typical is this of these kinds of economic adjustments when something new like this is introduced to the market?
I'm hard pushed to think of something that fluctuates this wildly. I think the thing about Bitcoin is it's essentially a technology stock. In some ways, it's a technology stock, and it's a very, 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 very young technology stock. What we're seeing here is as if we were seeing the public valuation of Twitter, not now, not immediately after its IPO, but in 2007, 2006. People are just throwing wild guesses out as to how big it could be, and everyone wants a chance to get in on the ground floor. You know, it won't. I would put money down on Bitcoin will not replace the US dollar. But this is one of the scenarios that people are considering when they buy Bitcoin. If it replaced the US dollar, you want to own it now, because even $800 a Bitcoin is nothing compared to how much each Bitcoin would be worth if the largest economy in the world used it as their exclusive method of transaction.
And certainly in the article that you wrote earlier this week, you did mention that things are starting to move in the direction of at least regulation or at least recognition by the U.S. Federal Reserve.
Yeah. I mean, it's basically just every big financial authority has looked at it and gone, if we don't come up with a coherent way of treating currencies like Bitcoin now, we're going to have to in the future, and it's best not to be taken by surprise. I think that's what's going through their mind here. And Bitcoin does pose some interesting problems. I mean, HMRC, the UK's tax authority, appears until now to have been sort of spitballing it, basically playing it by ear. So they're currently, you have to pay capital gains if you buy Bitcoin and then sell it as a profit later on. You also have to pay VAT if you purchase something with Bitcoin. So they're treating it as both a currency and a commodity, and that is rather unfair. They're going to have to sit down and sort it out. When you add into that, you know, regulations about money laundering, how you get banks involved, whether banks even are allowed to be involved, whether it counts as a regulated commodity that banks are allowed to buy, or whether it's something that, you know, they're just not allowed to because it's not something that's in the purview of banking. All of these are questions which have to be answered, and they have to be answered sooner rather than later, if nothing else, because if it does become a rapidly exploding high-growth technology stock sort of situation, banks want to get involved, you know, just like everyone else. They want to be able to make money off it.
I would sort of say that I mean, in terms of both a commodity and a currency, well, you just look at gold. You know, gold is regulated in much the same way. You can use gold as a currency, absolutely, and it has been historically. But also, it can be treated as a commodity, and you know, you get tax capital gains on that in the same way. Or if you use stuff as a medium exchange, then you could be taxed VAT on it.
As far as I know, you wouldn't be charged VAT on gold because it wouldn't be legally a transaction of the same way. But no, this is the problem. You know, these are the questions that Bitcoin comes up with, because you can't use gold to pay for coffee, and you can use Bitcoin to pay for coffee. And buying coffee is the sort of thing that we pay VAT on. And just because we're using a commodity to pay that bill rather than something which has more currency-like characteristics, these are questions. You know, frankly, tax is easy because the government can just sit down and declare that they can tax whatever they want. There's nothing intrinsic about the laws of taxation. They're just things set by a government. The trickier problems are when the economics of Bitcoin starts shaking out, because whether or not it's a currency or commodity does have a real effect on things like inflation. And these are the problems that are baked very firmly into the core of Bitcoin. There is only a fixed number of Bitcoins in existence, for instance.
But you can split it like crazy, can't you?
You can.
Well, in fact, just earlier this week, somebody either transacted or consolidated $480 million worth of Bitcoins, which means that one person or one account or one wallet has approximately 195,000 Bitcoins this week. So we're starting to see sort of these super users, as it were, sort of consolidating and hoping that that exchange rate will continue to go in their favor.
I think that one shook out to be a major Bitcoin exchange, which was consolidating holdings everywhere. It's hard to tell, but Bitcoin isn't entirely anonymous. You can link transactions with transactions with transactions, which are linked with somebody. And so some of the public wallet addresses of this major Bitcoin exchange appear to be linked to the account that now holds 195,000. But yeah, no, there are big players in it. I mean, and the Winklevoss are some. There are people who have invested millions and millions of dollars in Bitcoin. They're not going to let it sink without trace, and they're going to fight very hard for its success.
There is also an interesting question about what's actually underneath the surface of Bitcoin. If we just see it as simply a digital currency, then according to O'Reilly's Radar this week, they argue that it's also all about the awesome APIs that are underlying this service. You know, it's money as a service. It's open. It's flexible. It's kind of opening up the economy, is it not? So, Charles, what might we gain from this? I don't mean, you know, me and you individually.
But, oh, okay.
But,
I thought it was an offer.
Us as human beings, an understanding of economics, or even just, you know, how might this affect our economic principles?
If you get to the point where the price of Bitcoin compared to dollars, another currency, actually stabilizes, I mean, I don't know how close or far off that point is. It could be a long way off. Then I think you get to then you have a situation where you really do have digital cash, which is something that people have wanted for ages. And, you know, this was actually the way that Alex described it to me, which made complete sense, which is, you know, at the moment you can't sort of buy something easily on the net. You have to go through, you know, credit cards or PayPal or whatever.
Yeah.
And, but, you know, with Bitcoin, you say, oh, I'd like that. I'll just send some money for it. And, you know, that was basically what kept Silk Road, the sort of online drugs and what have you marketplace, going. Was people said, hey, like that, I'll buy it, but didn't have to do it, you know, with their name attached as such, and you know, a lot of cash transactions are anonymous. So one could sort of imagine that you might at some point in the future reach a day where, you know, you say, oh yeah, I'd really like to have that. You call up the Bitcoin app on your smartphone. You say, yeah, sure, send this to that address. Bing, bang, there you go, and everything's done.
I think the programmable money aspect of Bitcoin, which I've heard from other people, for instance, Mike Hearn, a Bitcoin developer, told me much the same thing. He compared Bitcoin.
No relation, I'm assuming.
No relation, no. There's an A in his name, you see. It's very important. He pointed out that his analogy is that Bitcoin is the internet and that PayPal is the equivalent of AOL or CompuServe, one of these nice little walled gardens that existed in the early days of the World Wide Web. I can see what they're saying. There are built into the very core of Bitcoin the ability to do things that you can't do with real money. The example O'Reilly gives is, for instance, you can have a transaction which needs to be signed by multiple people to go. So as in, you can have the wallet of a company authorize a transaction to client, and then you can have the CTO and the CEO need to sign it. But I think these are niche applications. I think, like Charles says, the real import of Bitcoin is that of all of the digital payment mechanisms we've got today, it is the one that is closest to being like cash. And cash has some advantages which we haven't been able to replicate online.
So, Alex, is Bitcoin the proverbial end of the line? I mean, I'm hearkening back to Linden dollars when everybody was so excited about Linden dollars and you could exchange them for cash and the people were millionaires and this and that and the other. So, you know, I feel in some ways like I've seen this. We've seen other examples of virtual currencies, of digital cash or that kind of thing coming up. So is Bitcoin the end of the line or will it fade out and then other things replace it?
I think Bitcoin is a lot more interesting than Linden dollars. Linden dollars are fundamentally just a ledger sitting on the computers of Linden Labs, the makers of Second Life, which said that people had X number of Linden dollars and the economy is basically tied to a game. It was fun, but it's easy to see how it could fade out of view. Bitcoin is at heart, and what interests me about it, an incredibly innovative technological solution to a problem which has plagued digital currencies, which is how to stop double spending without this sort of central ledger. How do you make it so that I can give some money to Charles without them just turning around and giving that same money to someone else without a central authority saying, no, no, you've already spent it? Bitcoin basically is magic maths. I'm not going to go into it here. Magic maths. Let's call it magic maths.
Can you tell Alex did humanities at university?
Hey, I studied economics, I'll have you know.
That's magic maths as well.
Charles, would you like to hear about the distributed proof-of-work ledger that lies behind Bitcoin? We could go well into
economics is a human science, right? It's fallible. It's philosophy. Anyway, I won't debate the philosophy of our world economic system. Please continue, Alex.
Bitcoin has a very interesting technological solution to this problem. And I think whether or not Bitcoin itself survives, and there are some major flaws with it that mean that in its current form, it's limited, whether or not it survives, this magic maths solution to the problem is worth keeping an eye on because it could go far. And if it's not Bitcoin, the currency of the future will be fundamentally based on the ideas behind Bitcoin.
Well, you can read more on Bitcoin across The Guardian, but mostly at theguardian.com/technology. Sir Tim Berners-Lee has said that government online surveillance activities have undermined the public's confidence in the web. He made this claim last week when announcing the latest web censorship figures collected from the Web Index, a service of his World Wide Web Foundation. Now, according to the BBC, this year's index suggests that 94% of the countries included do not adequately monitor government web interception, and 30% block or filter political content. Charles, how concerned should we be about these figures? Have they changed much over the last few years?
Well, the first web index was actually introduced last year, and we had Tim on the program then introducing it. I did ask him, well, are you going to keep on doing this every year? And he said, aha, I knew The Guardian would be asking this. And indeed we are. So there's not many years that we have to compare it against. Last year, what he was saying was, well, people did worry about the internet being turned off in countries. This was sort of after the Arab Spring and so on, when countries such as Egypt, before its present leadership, had, during the revolution, tried to just completely sever the internet. And we saw a number of occasions when that was tried in other countries. And he was saying, you can't really turn off the internet. It just doesn't happen. But now he says that there's more concern about the levels of surveillance as revealed by all the Snowden disclosures this year. And that he thinks that has a far more chilling effect. Because when the internet is turned off, he says, and Jimmy Wales of Wikipedia was also there at the launch of the Web Index, and they were making the same point broadly, which is, you know, if you turn off the web, it's really obvious that there's no internet, and people tend to get a bit antsy about it. And if you do it for long enough, then they will start, you know, protesting in the streets. It's not exactly that they're annoyed at the fact they can't see YouTube videos of cats, but they're rather annoyed at the fact that their government is shutting them down. If you surveil what people are doing, if you're silently watching where they go and what they do and who they write to and so on, then that in effect has a chilling effect because people start to censor themselves. And that's more dangerous than if you're explicitly censoring the web. So The point that's made in the index about so many countries not adequately monitoring web interception, the fact that 30% do block or filter political content, he says, yes, this is important. But equally, the whole online surveillance thing has much more subtle effects, which we should be aware of.
Now, there was an interesting comment on the Guardian's coverage of this. Somebody said, well, wait until the government releases or rolls out, you know, free broadband to the 10 major cities in the UK. Would that ultimately, would the chilling effect of what they were potentially doing actually come to pass? Or would people just say, you know what, hey, we've got free internet, we're going to forget all of this stuff, and we're just going to continue talking like we always have done?
The difficulty there is that the effects of surveillance are much more at the edges of society, for both sort of good and bad. So for the people where it has a chilling effect in a bad way, they're the people who are sort of, you know, they're not sure of their identity. You know, they might be gay, but they're in a, say, a family which is very, you know, homophobic or something. And they're worried that in some way or form, if they go and look for this stuff online, that somehow it'll come back to them. And you know, there have been examples year after year of people who've had this sort of problem. Or, you know, people who have been, I don't know, held as slaves, or people who have been, you know, trafficked, or whatever. There's always the sort of the noise around surveillance and the worries about being secretly surveilled always come back to you. For most people, sure, most people don't worry, because why should you? You know, they don't feel that they're a target of state surveillance. They don't feel that actually it's going to make any difference to their lives, that the things they look at aren't going to, you know, be of any interest to anyone. But it's more at the edges, and it's those sorts of edge cases, you know. And you can make a case that surveillance has societal benefits if it helps you catch the bad guys. But equally, if it has a chilling effect on the way that people in society behave, then you can argue that you know, does the good outweigh the bad?
At the announcement, as you mentioned, Jimmy Wales of Wikipedia was also there, and he argued that the whistleblowers' claims are having a bad effect on the West's reputation. You know, ultimately, because we have the Snowdens, because we have, you know, the other whistleblowers who have come before, of which there are several, suddenly the West is getting a really bad reputation. To what degree do you think that's the case?
What Jimmy Wales said was, he said, you know, I go to China and I go to speak to their ministers there and I say, you know what, you should really make Wikipedia available over here, because more knowledge is good for people. You know, censoring people or, you know, blocking stuff isn't good. And if we are shown to be in the West, if we're shown to be sort of surveilling people, if we're, you know, have all this extensive surveillance that we keep secret from people, then it doesn't look very good. So just to be clear, he's not saying that the whistleblowing is bad. He's saying the extent of the surveillance is a bad thing. And I mean, you know, you could sort of see that countries which exercise censorship, well, they're going to seize on any sort of implied bad action by governments who they don't like to bolster their case. That doesn't necessarily mean that they're right, therefore, to carry on with censorship. And I think that this is really Jimmy Wales's argument, is that actually, you know, it's not as if the Chinese are doing something right, because we might be doing something that's not entirely, you know, not entirely good. It's more that it makes it more difficult for him to show a completely unopposable argument.
But is non-surveillance of the web, whether it's commercial or whether it's government, actually possible? Because certainly, you know, even on the Guardian's website, there are trackers that help to, you know, direct advertising so that the Guardian online can make cash. So is it even possible?
You can make yourself very private. You can use systems like Tor, which means it's impossible to trace you back to your origin. You can block all sorts of trackers. You can use HTTPS so that you can't be monitored, you know, what actually is passing between you and a website. Though it's still pretty comparatively easy to see what websites you're connecting to if someone wants to monitor your connection.
And the problem is, of course, that it's quite nice being tracked by some services some of the time. It's really useful not having to log into Facebook and all those different sites that plug into Facebook. It's really helpful that Google knows, you know, not only when you sign into Gmail, but also can give you the best search things. We like these things. And when you switch to a fully anonymized, fully private web, you lose those as well. For some people, that's an advantage. Some people get a bit creeped out by the extent to which Google can guess what you're going to search for before you've even typed the first letter. But most of us find it quite useful.
Well, if you're confused about what's actually been going on with the NSA, then you can head to theguardian.com/technology, where Jemima Kish narrates a fantastic animation that explains exactly what's going on. Eight years ago, the Authors Guild took Google to court, claiming that the erstwhile search engine, now, well, everything, was infringing copyright by digitizing published works and making them available in snippets to anyone who looked. It has actually been a brutal and long battle. At its heart is a question of fair use of creative materials online. Charles, if you wouldn't mind casting your mind back, what was the catalyst for this case?
So back in 2005, well, it's actually slightly before that, Larry Page realized that you could use simple digital scanners, stick a book on it, use the OCR, optical character recognition software, and basically you could stick all the contents of the book into a computer, which is hardly a great revelation. But his idea was you could take all the books that haven't yet been digitized or weren't available in digital form from publishers, you could scan them, including what are called orphan works, which are books which have been published which for which the author is unknown or dead, which are perhaps out of copyright, where the publisher doesn't have any sort of digital copy and isn't interested in making one, that you could scan pretty much everything in creation, and to sort of save any problem like the Library of Alexandria burning down, which was one of the great calamities of history, Google would save all the books and would have it all backed up. And if you wanted to search for some phrase which was in a book, then all you'd have to do would be type it into Google. It would give you a list of books where these phrases appeared and show you extracts from the books if you clicked on them.
That's the case for, hey, it makes the world infinitely searchable, and it saves the potential of losing these great and also some of the not so great works. On the other side, what was the case against?
Case against is pretty simple. You open up any book and you look in the front cover and it says no part of this book may be stored in any form, electronic, mechanical or otherwise, without express permission of the publisher. Now, that seems to me pretty unambiguous. And the fact that Google went ahead and said, yeah, it says that, but we don't really care, and went and stuck it into its computers anyway, seemed to the Authors Guild to be a pretty dramatic misbehavior, I guess might be the phrase. So they were looking for not just damages, but also for Google to stop doing it altogether unless they had the explicit permission of the authors and the publishers for each specific book.
Now, over the last 8 years, Google has continued to do this. I remember there was great surprise and in some circles, hurrahs about the fact that they were doing the entirety of, Oxford's libraries and this and that and the other. So they've continued to do this, but the ruling only arrived this week. What was the ruling?
So the ruling in the United States said that the use of these books is what's called fair use. That is, it's part of the copyright law, which says you can reproduce small extracts from a larger work without having to make any payment and without, under the law, infringing copyright, as long as these are small snippets of the larger work. The Authors Guild had argued that because Google had the whole book and because it would keep on showing you large chunks, that in effect it was the reproduction of the book, that infringed copyright, that it wasn't fair use. Google argued that it was only small parts. The judges decided that because these snippets weren't necessarily contiguous, because Google would never show the whole of a book, that therefore it amounted to fair use under the US Copyright Act. Now, that doesn't necessarily apply in Europe, and it'll be interesting to see whether the same case is going in Europe. European laws, and certainly British laws on fair use, are not quite congruent with American ones. So I wouldn't say that this is over. And in the US, of course, the Authors Guild, I don't think, is going to throw in the towel here. They can keep arguing this one all the way up to the Supreme Court, and are very likely to.
Well, thank you very much to Charles Arthur and Alex DeHearn. And do remember that for all of these stories and so much more, you can go to theguardian.com/technology. The evolution of the novel has been bound for centuries to one technology, paper and print. But as the era of ebooks and alternative technologies for longer-form storytelling gets underway, writers are confronted with a bewildering range of choices. And it was in such a befuddled state that author and publisher Eli Horowitz and his co-author Kevin Moffitt conceived of the digital novel The Silent History. The work comes in the form of an app for iPhone or iPad, and it's released episodically. It's based in New York and tells the story of a generation of people born without the capacity for language, the silence. Now, earlier this year at the Sydney Writers' Festival, I caught up with Eli at the bustling and rather noisy conference hall, and I started out by asking him how the Silent History app could be defined as a novel.
So it's a novel that we really approach trying to think, how can a novel, how should it exist in this new form? If a novel is going to be on these devices, what can it do in a different way? How can it tell a story in a new way? Because it seemed like a lot of what we were getting as e-books were sort of just pale gray imitations of print books. And it seemed like if we were going to lose all the nice things about a print book, we should be getting something good in return. And so this was our attempt to start exploring that. So The Silent History is partly a long serialized novel, over 120 parts that come to you once a day. And it's partly a map with a 300 different site-specific updates that you can read or ignore if you don't want to. But for people who want to delve more deeply into the world of the story, you can go to these spots and actually be on site and read what happens at that site. The GPS of your phone matches the coordinates of the location, and you start to understand the location in a new way. It uses the artifacts and settings of that location to help tell a story in a new way.
It's interesting. It's kind of a combination of a... Actually, I don't know if it's a choose-your-own-adventure necessarily, because I don't know how much the reader or the consumer has control over the plot of the story. But there's obviously a lot of geocaching that's gone in there. How much is it that the reader can direct the story, or is it very much authored by you, and then all of these other site-specific elements are just kind of enhancing the immersibility of the experience?
Yeah, I would say it's explore your own adventure. The thing is fully written, and I have a lot of doubts about choose your own adventure, as much as I loved it as an 11-year-old, but that's, I think, what people instantly think of as the equivalent of interactive fiction when they hear about interactive fiction. But I think that's really only one sliver, and maybe the most obvious and limited way. You know, interaction with a book, anytime you turn the page, you're interacting with a book. Anytime you look at the world and think about it in a different way in relation to a book, you're interacting with a book. Anytime you talk about a book, you're interacting with it. So I think there's a lot of potential for all sorts of different ways to interpret what that could mean.
So what were the inspirations for this? I mentioned geocaching. I don't know if that was an aspect of what you were thinking about as you were developing this. There are other existing interactive, or they're not app-based necessarily, but they're certainly digitally-based stories that are out there. What did you draw on from that canon? What did you draw on from the print canon? And what did you draw on from canons that had nothing to do with storytelling?
For me, I'm actually, even though I made this weird high-tech novel, I'm actually, for the most part, a late adopter of all these things and sort of a Luddite. But I think it is important for all these innovations or whatever to be based in some actual storytelling desire. So for me, what this came out of was, I have the experience, and I think a lot of people do, when you really love a book or really love a movie, it ends, but you want to just stay in that world, and you want to go deeper in that world, and you want to see what's off the page or off the screen. Every time I see a zombie movie, I wonder, what was happening in Hawaii? What was happening in Australia? Like, these islands, did they guard their shores really carefully? Or who ran the sewer system? How long did that work? Boring little stuff. And I really wanted to hold on to those worlds and explore them in more detail. So this was trying to think of, how could a novel be a novel but also infinitely expandable, to let the reader who, if you're obsessed with it, if you're not obsessed, you just read it, fine. But if you are obsessed, you go deeper and deeper and deeper and try and, in a novel that rewarded that kind of obsession.
And there's an element of contribution, isn't there? I mean, you're curating some of the site-specific elements, the sort of geolocated aspects of story. Is that for superfans, or is that for storytellers, or how does that work?
Yeah, well, so these site-specific pieces are largely written by the readers of it who submit it, and, you know, I'll be editing and curating them. But to be honest, that didn't come from any grandiose ideals of collaboration. It came from the fact that I needed these 300 spots all across the world, and I couldn't go to 300 spots across the world, and other people were in spots all across the world. So it was really about problem solving as much as anything, and we sort of backed into this high concept futuristic version of it. But it's been nice to see, definitely.
What was your development process as a writer? I mean, how did that go? Were you just suddenly, did you wake up one day and say, aha, this internet thing is going to be big?
There was sort of a year of feeling frustrated about ebooks and not wanting to learn about ebooks because I sort of had to in my job as a publisher. Then there was a year of just walking on sidewalks a lot and, if possible, bringing someone with me and rambling to them a lot while I tried to figure out the idea, because no single piece of this is actually so innovative or groundbreaking. It's just the way that the pieces fit together that hopefully makes it work. So there's a year of that. Then there was 2 years of us actually writing the thing, because it's about 500 pages long, even without the site-specific things. And then a year of programming, of development.
So obviously the digital nut is something that publishers are desperate to crack, and this goes some way, given that you have a reputation within the print world, and you have a platform on which to convey this. What issues from digital publishing do you think you've solved with this?
None. I don't think I've solved anything, but I also don't think it's a matter of solving it. I don't think it's the time to solve things. It's not that I'm saying the future of publishing is a bunch of people standing on dirty sidewalks trying to read things and figuring, you know. The future of publishing is just trying a whole bunch of things and seeing what tells us the stories that we want to hear and stories that we want to experience, which has always been the, you know, the project of literature and publishing. So we just need to keep pushing that forward and not let ourselves be limited by, you know, what's the platform that has the most scalability for someone to capture market share and be, you know, things like that.
Great. Well, Eli Horowitz, A Silent History, The Silent History, is available on an app store near you.
The Silent History by Eli Horowitz and Kevin Moffitt is out now. You can find out more by going to thesilenthistory.com. We'll have links in the Tech Weekly blog at theguardian.com/techweekly. That's all we have for you today. Remember that this Sunday, the Observer Tech Monthly Supplement is out and is stacked full of great stories from the frontier of technology and science, so don't miss it. But from me, Alex Kratofsky, and Tech Weekly producer Jason Phipps, we'll be back next Wednesday. Thanks for listening.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, drag-and-drop tools, and 24/7 support. Squarespace also offers seamless e-commerce solutions for you or your small business. Every design automatically includes a unique mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website, so your content will look brilliant on any device. Start your free trial today, no credit card required. As a Guardian podcast listener, you'll get 10% off your new account by using the offer code Guardian.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.